Welcome to Women in the Arena podcast, the podcast celebrating women doing extraordinary things in plain sight. I'm your host, Audra Egan, and our mission is to elevate the value, strength, and resilience each woman brings to the world. Without further delay, let's go ahead and start the show. Welcome in, everyone, and thank you so much for joining me again this week. This week's structure is a little bit different than my normal shows, but I got this unique opportunity to speak with today's guest, and I wanted to be able to do it justice. My guest this week is Susanna Cahalan, and she is the author of Brain on Fire, which is also a Netflix movie of the same name. She's here to discuss her book, her unique illness, and how it manifested itself psychologically. And because this is such an interesting and complicated topic, I invited in some help. I have a co-host today with my friend, Dr. Susan Manful, and you may remember her as the mother of Alex Manful, who unfortunately passed away at a very young age from an illness that was very similar to the one that Susanna has experienced. I really am excited about this conversation. It's fascinating, it's complicated, and it definitely brings up all kinds of interesting questions and topics that I can't wait to dive into. It is both my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Susanna. Susanna, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I also am joined by my co-host today, Dr. Susan Manful, and she's going to help with some of the conversation today because this is such an amazing subject. It is also a complicated one. And we want to make sure that we get the questions right. So I have help. Once again, thank you for joining us. And you are this remarkable woman that has survived a very unusual diagnosis. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what NMDAR encephalitis is?
Absolutely. So autoimmune encephalitis in general is when the body's immune system begins to target areas of the brain. In my case, it was the NMDA receptors of the brain. And the NMDA receptors are located all over the brain. And they're kind of known as like a foundational building block of the brain. But they're in high concentrations in areas that deal with cognition, behavior, and memory. And so when you start to mess with those receptors, you start to mess with those areas. And if you kind of knock out all of those NMDA receptors, that can lead to coma and death. It's really interesting because the illness itself is kind of a study in the role of the NMDA receptor in the brain as well, which I am a complete neophyte. And I kind of think I know what a receptor is, but I'm learning a little bit about how my illness functioned in my own body, kind of gave me a greater kind of respect for the brain and kind of admiration for the brain in a way.
What makes you think that you are a little bit more susceptible to that? And because I mean, anybody could get it. I mean, but what makes you think, or what made you a little bit more prone to this, that you came with this crazy diagnosis?
You know, it's such that is a key question in the field that has not been answered. That remains a mystery. Why typically women of a certain age between 18 and 24 typically are affected by this, though I've heard of patients who are as young as 6 months, as old as 86. So everything in between, but it does tend to congregate around women around age 20. That's the kind of average age, I believe, at this point. And so what made me susceptible was the fact that I am a woman, and I was 24 at the time. I think that would be the kind of predisposing factors that would make me more susceptible. But there's a question of the fact that these antibodies are crossing. First of all, these antibodies are created in the first place. Why are these brain targeted antibodies created? In some patients, they have what's called a teratoma, and a teratoma is a kind of mass that can be anywhere, but in this case, it's in the ovary. And it can be created of bone, teeth. Don't look them up. They're terrifying. But bone, teeth, brain matter. And what the idea is that your body starts to target this teratoma as a foreign agent and then creates these brain targeting antibodies because there's brain matter in the teratoma. And then somehow they cross the blood brain barrier and get into your brain. I didn't have a teratoma, and the vast majority of cases do not have teratomas. So the cause, this kind of precipitating factor that creates these autoantibodies in the first place, big question mark. The second big question mark is how they're able to cross the blood-brain barrier. What makes that barrier porous? It could be a virus, maybe. It looked like I might have had some virus before the illness, but that's another big, big mystery.
Interesting. So were you feeling poorly before you came down with this insane diagnosis?
You know, it's hard to kind of like the edges of the illness are hard to kind of say where it's, oh, here's the beginning, here's the middle, and here's the end. So I would, you know, looking back, I've imposed a narrative upon it, but it seems to me there's kind of like these rough edges. You know, I had real kind of lethargy, I was tired, I was kind of depressed. And that's kind of known as the prodromal phase, that flu-like phase, that maybe I had some kind of viral onslaught that made me very tired. Or maybe that was the early part of the illness itself. And now that's a big question too. And, you know, I became convinced that my apartment was infested with bed bugs. That wasn't that out extraordinary at the time. This was 2009. Everyone was terrified of bed bugs. It was had infested New York City. They were in park benches. They were in movie theaters. So, you know, is my reaction, I'm not the kind of person who typically has that kind of big reaction to things like that. I'm way more laid back than I should be actually about things like that. So my real obsessive reaction and fear to me signals that there was a start there. But again, I don't know, you know, I don't know if that's the beginning.
So Susanna, I just want to say that it's really an honor to have this opportunity to talk to you. And Audra, I just want to thank you again for inviting me to be part of this. Happy 10th anniversary.
Thank you.
It's hard to imagine that it was 10 years ago that your book came out. I remember it very well. So I'm excited to follow up on some of the things that you wrote about. And I would also like to talk about some of them in light of the disorder that our daughter had, which is commonly known as PANDAS and PANS, but it is also referred to as a basal ganglia encephalitis as well. We're all hoping to change the name from PANDAS and PANS to something more... well, more descriptive of what the issues may be, like
an Susan, I think that's key. I think that's a key thing. Labels are really important. There's something, and I've encountered this. I've had a lot of interaction with the PANS and PANDAS community and been kind of amazed by advocacy that they're pushing against this strange, I don't understand like why it's been stigmatized in some circles. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, does it come down to the name? Like, I don't know. Is it because it has this kind of fairly... the acronym is PANDAS. I don't know, but it's straight. It always has been kind of mind boggling to me as to why that this community seemed to have faced some kind of, at least from some medical authorities, some kind of pushback. And I never really understood. And I wonder if they called it basal, because when you said basal, I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that was the prevailing. And I think it's a wonderful description. It's like anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis. It tells you what it is in the name.
Right. Only in this case, it occurs in the basal ganglia area.
Right.
You see symptoms reflective of that region of the brain. So, I mean, it's also called our group, the Alex Manful Fund tends to call it an immune-mediated neuropsychiatric disorder, which, of course, the NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis would fall under as well. But so, I mean, there are similarities, of course, because ours... It relates to the immune system. Autoimmunity is involved, or at least some aspect of the immune system in general just has gone awry. There's inflammation. But the big difference, of course, is that there is a diagnostic marker for the NMDAR encephalitis, and there is not one for basal ganglia encephalitis. So one of my first questions, and it's one that you write about, I've read both of your books, and I hope we have a moment to talk about your second book as well. You. As you well know, it's very difficult to distinguish NMDAR encephalitis from your classic or your primary psychiatric disorder. And so therefore, it's not recognized, it's not diagnosed, hence it's not treated. And years can go by. In the case of our daughter, years went by because no one diagnosed what her issues were. And as you point out in your writing, there's the possibility of brain damage. So how do we change that?
Oh, wow. I mean, isn't that the million-dollar question right there?
Yeah,
I can tell you in terms of my little tiny slice of what I do, you know, what was just sharing my story, was being vocal about what happened to me and doing it in a way that was kind of palatable, that people would want to read and people would want to engage with. That was what was really important to me initially, getting the word out that this was a possibility. And it wasn't just getting the word out to the medical field, but getting the word out to the patients and the caregivers, most importantly, themselves, that they could know, that they could advocate and they could say, which has happened, I would say hundreds of times, out of this book is that parents or friends have said, you got to test your daughter for this. You got to test your son for this. That has been this outcome of the book that I'm so proud of, that it actually has armored some caregivers with information. It might not lead you to the same diagnosis that I had, but hey, it might lead you down a path that might end up with basal ganglia encephalitis, because now that you know that there's an immune mediated response that physicians didn't know about 10 years ago. Some still don't know about it. That is an option, that is an area to be investigating. I think that whether or not it leads to the same diagnosis that I had, this questioning of medical authority, of pushing back, of realizing that unfortunately doctors don't have all the answers. Not by far. There's so many mysteries, and that there's a range in care. There are great doctors and there are not so great doctors, just like anywhere else. And I think you kind of see the kind of range in this book. And it gets a lot worse, obviously, than this book. I think mostly I was very lucky. But just being aware of the fact that, you know, that you have to ask questions, that you have to push. And it's really hard, especially for yourself, because you can't advocate for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important. You can't advocate for yourself. And as a young a child with an autoimmune encephalitis, your parents can advocate for you. As a young adult, sometimes it's difficult to find an advocate. And you were so lucky to have your parents and your, at that time, boyfriend to advocate for you. So I think that's the other good thing that your book does as well, is to recognize the importance of advocacy. But you do wonder, in response to something you said, you know, why can't doctors just acknowledge, I don't know everything. Let me consult someone else. Let me do some research. I wish they taught that in medical school.
Wow. I mean, that has completely, I feel it's this teaching of a humane and hubristic approach, a lack of hubristic approach to medicine, where you can say, I don't know, and that's okay, because there's so much we don't know. And I think I think that the medical system really does not support that kind of thinking, because insurance companies need a diagnosis to get reimbursed. You have such little time to actually engage with a patient. And I don't know won't get you reimbursed for your time. And so it's actually incentivized to go to quick answers and the easiest answers, instead of really saying, okay, we need to dig in here. And the problem is, even if a doctor's putting a placeholder diagnosis and they know, we don't really know, but we have to get reimbursed by an insurance company, that placeholder diagnosis, especially if it's psychiatric, can completely derail your treatment going forward.
Exactly. These are the stories that I hear from the parents that I talk to. Can I keep going?
Keep going.
So Audra and I have discussed all of this ahead of time, and we're on the same page about what we'd like to know. So it kind of related to what you're saying, and you've written about this as well, that it's such an important point, that once you move from a psychiatric diagnosis to an organic diagnosis. In other words, probably neurology, but some sort of quote unquote medical disorder. The status of your case is elevated. And you point out that isn't that so unfortunate, because isn't the brain the source of this? And so, I think you do, you know, you do such a good job in pointing that out. And isn't the brain the source of it? Aren't all major psychiatric disorders, we're probably going to find out, is related to the immune system, at least exacerbating it or causing it? So I guess this is kind of based on that, on what you've written about. What do you think psychiatry could do to repair their reputation, maybe, or how can they make fill in the gap between psychiatry and the rest of medicine?
It's so hard, right? I mean, psychiatry, I spend a lot of time with psychiatrists for my second book, and I've seen the best and I've seen the worst of the field. And you know, when psychiatry is done and it's what it's actually intended to be humane, to be creative, to be engaged with a patient, it's actually clinical care at its best. It's not an easy field. Every single condition that once we figure out the kind of source, the etiology of it, it gets removed from psychiatry and put into neurology. So it's almost like a foundational part of being in psychiatry is that we don't know the actual cause of what the condition of what we're talking about.
Oh, that's,
you know, it's almost baked into the field. And I think, you know, that is, they're contending with the unknown constantly. So it is it's a really hard field when you're doing it right. It's really gauging people on a humane humanity level and the kind of art of clinical care. So I have a lot of respect for psychiatrists who do it well. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. not all psychiatrists do it well. And I think in terms of what can be done, I believe names are very important. And I think we agree on that. Names are very, very important. And it seemed like what was formerly known as PANDAS is a perfect example of the name, how names can kind of create reality, right? So mm-hmm. I think that things like schizophrenia should not be called schizophrenia. I believe that they should be called psychosis, not otherwise specified, or be broken down according to their symptoms and kind of mapped out what's called dimensionally, which means that they're kind of putting these symptoms out. I mean, it's not, problem is orienting name is very important. When I thought I had bipolar disorder, I felt so relieved because I had an answer. So, you know, you don't want to do away with names completely, but the problem is there's so much stigma, there's so much misinformation attached to things like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, where they seem like the end of the road. Once you've gotten that, that's it. It's like all inquiries stop, where that's not true. There's so much we don't know about what causes, what it is. What is schizophrenia is still such a question that if you ask people who research it, you know, they don't really have a solid answer either. And actually most research doesn't revolve around schizophrenia. It revolves around specific symptoms. So I kind of wish that psychiatrists would be more open about the fact that these names have a big stigma, have a big meaning attached to it that they probably don't deserve or should have, that maybe we should drop some of these names and be more kind of forthright, be more straightforward about the fact that we don't know so much. And I think that it's baked into those names. And so I would like to see those names moving forward kind of be done away with.
That's a really interesting point. And I guess for a long time in psychiatry, there's been a small number of people, and it seems that the voice is quite quiet in advocating for a view like you've just espoused. But it does seem more and more important that since we are recognizing that the cause, the etiology of the presenting symptoms is what matters, because that's what's going to tell you how to treat this. And so, for example, in the case of yours, once you were identified as having the antibodies for the NMDAR encephalitis, you could be treated.
Yes. Yes.
Effectively. And the same is true with these disorders, the basal ganglia encephalitis and other immune-mediated disorders. So when you talk about names, I'm reminded, I think in your first book, you talk about what psychiatrists were called in the 19th century.
Yes, alienists.
Yeah. So they certainly knew that they needed to change their yes. name in order to, you know, to make some progress. So when you went to go, when you went through all the doctors that you went through and they gave you what their thoughts were, based on the information that they understood. I mean, how did that make you feel when I would feel in sitting in your shoes that I wasn't heard. I mean, how did you feel?
You know, at the time I was not my best advocate and I was saying things like I have multiple personality disorder. That's what I was saying, you know? So I didn't have that feeling of not being heard. I didn't know. And I also didn't know to the extent to which I was very, very close to being moved to the kind of psychiatric floor until after I got my medical records. I didn't know how close I was. That wasn't communicated directly. It was communicated in kind of offhand remarks made, but it wasn't communicated directly. And nor were the rule out diagnoses. No one at any point told me or my parents that the rule out diagnosis was schizoaffective disorder. That was never communicated. That was only communicated through my medical records when I got my hands on them later. So, but even at that time, had I heard that, I wouldn't have, you know, I probably would have agreed with it. So I wasn't, I was definitely not my best advocate at that point. You know, I know my mom very much specifically was pushing against a psychiatric diagnosis. And partially that came from the fact, I mean, it came from many different aspects, you know, her knowing me, you know, obviously her knowing me very intimately, she's my mom, but also because my stepfather, who I am very close with, he grew up with a brother who had schizophrenia. And, in the case of his brother, those symptoms, though he was not diagnosed till much later, and that was during the schizophrenogenic mother stage of psychiatry. But he shared a room with his brother and he saw what it was like. Of course, everyone's different. There's no one way schizophrenia presents, but he had known me since I was a child. It did not make sense to him, given his own personal experience being that close to someone who had schizophrenia, that would be what was going on with me. So I think, you know, combination of my mom knowing me so well and my stepfather's experience as a child really kind of galvanized and like solidified their fight really to make sure that I was being heard, even if I was saying, I wasn't saying the right things, but you know.
Yeah. So again, the importance of advocates.
I would say I didn't do anything to advocate for myself. It's funny because I get a lot of emails from people saying, what can I do as a kid? And I kind of think I'm not the right person to ask because I was not an advocate for myself at all. You know, my parents were amazing and my now husband was amazing and, you know, so, but I was not.
talking about being on the other side of your illness and learning all of those different diagnoses, how did you deal with, in layperson's terms, how did you deal with the idea of losing your mind, as they say?
Yeah, I mean, it was
all those very serious diagnostic categories with your name attached.
Yeah, I mean, in the recovery process, when I was well enough to understand what the implication of that meant, I was really very, very ashamed of a lot of those hallucinations, the psychosis, the way I behaved. I was very ashamed of it. And it was only when I started learning about autoimmune encephalitis where where I started seeing it as this kind of act of God visited upon me as opposed to something that came from me. Then I could talk about it and I felt free to talk about it. It was an interesting thing that I didn't realize I was participating in this stigmatization of serious mental illness. I didn't realize I was engaging in that, but I was. The minute I was like neurobiological, then I can talk about the psychosis because it's not me. It's something that happened to me. But of course, someone with schizophrenia, it's something that happened to them too. It's not them. It's not the core who they are. But it was just, it's an interesting thing. And it did lead to the second book, that question of why someone is called schizophrenic where I'm not called encephalopathic. I mean, that's not really like, that's not how I identify, you know? So it was an interesting, it's an interesting, again, use of words, which is such an interesting theme that we're bringing up together that I think we keep coming back to, is the idea that these words, medical labels have effects, and they come with sets of meanings, and they can change outcomes.
So I was wondering if you could just tell us, I know you've written about this a little bit, but in your own words, how long did it take you to feel yourself again? And how did your self come back?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's interesting because I was a really, I was a terrible judge of my own recovery. I was just very kind of, I almost like blinders on, where I was just, I'm better, I'm fine, I'm better. And I think that helped me in a way in recovering, just being absolutely not backward thinking at all, forward thinking. So I was routinely saying things, I'm back, I'm better, I'm 90% or whatever, you know, and my mom would have to say, you're not, you know, you have to slow down, or, you know, no, you're 70% of yourself, you know, like when they'd have to do those assessments. So I'm not a great judge, but I looking back, I think it took me through the writing of Brain on Fire to get back. I thought that I was, when I was sold the book and was working on it, you sell on proposal and then you work on the book. I had a year to write it. And I thought 100% I was better. But what was interesting is that they have these things called these talent scouts that scout out, like, you know, books to make into movies. And someone saw a first draft of they saw the proposal, and then they saw the first draft of the book. And I later met her, and she said, I saw this dramatic improvement between your proposal and your first draft of your book. And it was at that moment that I realized I was still recovering. I was writing through my recovery. I didn't realize it's so subtle that I don't even think you yourself could be aware of, like, these. I mean, especially when you're dealing with writing and words on a page, you really tap into I need all brain cell, you know, I need everything. So I think it really kind of showed how much I was still recovering, you know, 2 years later, really.
Mm-hmm. I think writing in and of itself does help us make sense of our issues, positive or negative. I think it's a great strategy. And that was actually one of my questions, whether writing the book did help you do that.
Absolutely. And you know, what's been amazing to me too, Susan, is that the people have reached out to me with all kinds of brain injuries, brain disease, whatever, not even anything related to brain injury or disease, who have gone through something traumatic or something painful. And they send me poems or books that they wrote, or, you know, paintings or crocheted hats. I don't know, you know, and they've been able to kind of impose these, like, this artistry and narrative on this painful, create something of meaning outside of it, has, like, really been amazing to see. And that's something I'm really proud of. That was a byproduct of the book that I didn't see coming at all. That has been really rewarding to be able to see.
Okay, so I have various social media accounts, and I ask people to let me know what they'd like to know from you. And let me just tell you first, again, that you've really made such a difference in the lives of people in this community, and we're all really grateful for that. So one other question was, for family and friends, how can you support someone who's recovering from autoimmune encephalitis? And is there anything that we shouldn't do or say?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard for, I can understand, it's a really tough situation, because I remember presenting a lot worse, a lot more impaired than actually I was experiencing the world. So I might not be able to say many things. I might be smiling and not really engaging, but I was noticing the baby talk or the talking really slow. I mean, you know, my mom and I went to a shoe store, and the salesperson said, you know, was just talking to my mom and completely neglecting, really enraged my mother, because this is a human too, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it can make people very uncomfortable, and I get it. I understand. You don't know what to do. You don't want to overwhelm someone. You don't want to assume someone is better than they are. You want to be able to engage with them on their level. But I will say, in my personal experience, I appeared more impaired than what I was actually taking from the world. So and this again is very personal to me. It might not be generalizable, but when I talk to someone who has this condition, I tend to try as best as I can to talk to them as I would someone who doesn't have it, and maybe even ask them, am I talking too fast? Or am I, you know, tell me if I'm going to, allowing them to be able to verbalize if they want you to slow down, or, you know, giving them some of the power in that exchange can be helpful. But it's hard. It's a hard dynamic. And, you know, when I've kind of crossed over to being a caregiver, my father had a traumatic brain injury. He got hit by a car, and all of a sudden I was on the other end of that. And it was challenging because I didn't know if I was making things worse, how I should be engaging. So it's not easy. It's not easy. But in my experience, I think trying to behave as you normally would is can be really comforting. Those are the people I really gravitated to in my recovery.
Great advice. Thank you. Loved your book, loved the movie, loved your second book. As a social psychologist who grew up in the time of David Rosenhan and Zimbardo.
Oh, Zimbardo, yes.
Yes. It was fascinating to read that
book.
Oh,
thank you.
We'd love to talk to you about that sometime.
Oh, I'd love to. We should definitely do that.
Okay.
And I'm working on
that's
a third book too.
That's our last question.
Yeah, our last question was, are you working on another book?
I am. I'm just about to hand it in a month. And this one's about psychedelics. So it's about psychedelics. It's about a kind of a unknown woman in the history of psychedelics who allows me to ask questions about like the promises and perils. You know, there's this magic bullet thing going on. And I think it's really, there's a lot of exciting stuff. There's a lot of bad science. There's some good science. So it's not as scientific or academic as my second book. It's more a biography and it's more kind of fun. And it's very of its time. It takes place in the 60s and 70s. I mean, and to somewhat current day. It's a biography. It's a different in design, but it does allow me to talk about altered states and the new promises of psychiatry, putting so much of their hopes into psychedelics. So
ketamine is related to NMDA receptors, right?
Okay, exactly. I would never do ketamine. I'm too scared of it because of the NMDA receptor, like not for any reason that I know, just because of my own NMDA receptor fear, but
I have got to wrap this up because I promised your publisher to get you out of here on time. Susanna, thank you so much.
This was incredible.
I was going to say, I really hope that we can talk to you again. We're not on such a time crunch.
I would love that. That would be very special to me if I could do this again, because this was the questions and Susan, your knowledge about this and intimate knowledge about this is obviously apparent. And thank you for your kind words. It's just really meaningful to me to hear that.
Well, thank you. And we will get back to you for sure and have more time to talk to you. So thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for being on my show.
Oh, it was a pleasure and an honor. Until
soon.
Thank
you so much. Yes, absolutely. Right. Thank you again.
Thank you so very much.
Wow. That was quite a remarkable experience. This is something that's very unusual. I've never had the opportunity to do this before. And we were limited on time, but if we have our way, we'll get Susanna back. So we thought that it would be really interesting for Susan and I to have a little bit of commentary on what we just heard.
It was an amazing experience. And again, I thank you, Audra, for including me in this. You know, in her book, she gives us such a bird's eye view of what her, of how she felt. You know, what was happening in her mind. It was amazing to talk with her.
What I think is really quite incredible is that she had a really significant illness that was affecting her psychologically, which could have left lasting damage. But she's written two books. You heard that she's writing a third. I mean, and she's become an advocate. It's even though she might have some lingering cognitive issues, it certainly hasn't affected her ability to continue to grow and move forward and become an unexpected advocate. How do you think had she not gotten treatment, how do you think that would have changed the outcome?
Well, had she not gotten the right treatment, she could be in the back ward of a hospital. She, in one of her books, I think it's the second one, I can't remember if she talks about it in the first one, but she talks about someone she refers to as her mirror image. And it's somebody else who was diagnosed with schizophrenia and a whole host of other disorders and treated with neuroleptics, and I believe she met her in the hospital. I'm not sure. But in any case, an extended 20-year bout with schizophrenia. But it sounded like it could be NMDA receptor encephalitis. She was tested for it. She does have the antibodies, but too much time has passed and her brain has sustained permanent damage.
So she had mentioned in the conversation that it's more commonly susceptible for women mm-hmm. and in their early 20s. Mm-hmm. And these symptoms they could be anything. You know, so how do we start to distinguish as parents, as friends, as family members, if an individual is displaying these very uncharacteristic like tendencies, how do we say to them, maybe we should take you to the doctor?
Yeah. Well, I think a key word, uncharacteristic. Mm-hmm. How uncharacteristic is it? I think another factor that you should be considering is the onset. Was this an acute onset, something that suddenly occurred? That would be another big hint. In the case of Susanna, it did come on in some ways quickly, but in other ways slowly. I mean, in retrospect, she thinks she probably did have symptoms for a while that she didn't recognize, the bed bugs being a really good example. But I think those keywords, uncharacteristic and the onset, in the case of other autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders, it may be that there has been an infection that occurred before, a viral infection or a bacterial infection. In the case of PANDAS, that's strep. Right now, strep is experiencing a surge in certain parts of the world, definitely in the UK, in France, in the Netherlands, and in the United States.
Yes.
Group A strep.
Pretty significant on the borders, meaning on the East Coast and the West Coast. I have found that, and I've been reading that it starts on the coast and then works its way inward.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So I've been reading a couple of articles that's what it's doing, is it's moving its way inward. And in the case of Alex, she had gotten strep at some point, you know, when she was a teenager, I think you had mentioned to me.
When she was 17, almost a week before her 18th birthday, she had strep when she was in Jordan. So we always wondered if that was a different strain of group A strep. And then later when she was 19. And her symptoms started occurring pretty much right after her bout with strep. So had it been recognized, had people known strep, obsessive compulsive sorts of symptoms and anxiety, for example, those were her two main symptoms. And she just had strep. Let's take another look at this.
So, I mean, that's not necessarily being paranoid, because some people will say, oh, you're just being paranoid. It's all in your head. Maybe it's just a second look. Maybe it's just being cautious, because there's so much we don't know right now. The ability for infections and viruses to start to penetrate that blood-brain barrier, we're starting to figure out that that's becoming a little bit more common than we first realized.
Exactly. And I would add trauma and environmental toxins to that, and metabolic issues to that list of triggers as well.
For those of you that are parents and your children have strep or some sort of illness, take a second look, just in case, because, you know, it's just better safe to be sorry. Her advocacy, I want to talk about that for just a
sure.
second with you. She has become a huge advocate for people in this particular study of science, of psychology, or I should say these viruses that now affect you psychologically. It's just her work putting into this effort. How do you think her action and her presence, how do you think it is impacting, or is it impacting, this study
of NMDA and mm-hmm. Receptor encephalitis? Huge. I mean, absolutely huge. It put it on the map. If I recall correctly, she was the 217th patient in the world to be diagnosed. No one had been diagnosed with this at NYU. I don't even think in the state of New York. And Dr. Dalmo had just published his paper 2 years earlier. So since that time, I've forgotten how many people have been diagnosed with this, but a huge number of people have been diagnosed with her particular disorder. I think she put it on the map. We'd love to put something on the map, or love to have something happen that puts pandas and pans on the map. Is the other thing that her book has done, and the fact that it got people so interested in it, is that it has increased the amount of funds that are available for research, which is huge.
Advocacy and research are what's going to push this forward. And also, it's not just her advocacy, but she's also encouraging those to advocate for themselves.
If they can.
And what Susan and I have talked about prior to this interview was the idea that when you go to the doctor and the doctor doesn't take you seriously and that you're not believed, and how that happens way more common for women than it does men, because you're hormonal, you're emotional, you're hysterical, you're all of this. I think after hearing her story, pushing for better answers, if you think that the answers that you are getting are not the right ones and it just doesn't fit, I think that she is a prime example of continuing to push until you find the answer that is most likely identified to attach to your diagnosis. Because had she given up, or had her parents given up, she would have been in a psych ward, not writing novels, or I should say writing essays and writing and advocating for others like her.
She might be weaving baskets.
Yeah, she might be weaving baskets at this point.
But there's on that subject, there's an excellent book it came out this year by Megan O'Rourke. It's called The Invisible Kingdom, Reimagining Chronic Illness. She's a writer for The New Yorker and Atlantic Magazine, and she has, I believe it's 3 autoimmune disorders. And she details in this excellent book her experience of going to doctors and not being heard and being diagnosed with some pretty wild things. I highly recommend that book. I think it's worth pointing out that there are 50 million Americans who have autoimmune diseases. And most people who have autoimmune, or many people who have autoimmune disorders, have more than one. And the number has grown tremendously. It's more than tripled in the last decade.
It's more than tripled.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, if you know anybody that has any sort of autoimmune disorder, you know that they suffer. They suffer with their disorder. They also suffer with going from doctor to doctor looking for answers. I have a very good friend of mine that has an autoimmune disorder that sees multiple doctors a year looking for answers, pushing for answers, and hasn't found any. She's not given up, but she's continuing to push until she finds an answer to finally either be heard or make her quality of life so much better than what she's living right now.
I mean, can you imagine how exhausting that is?
Even when you do normal things, going to the doctor, that's exhausting when you have to go and do the normal checkup. But going and explaining your story and explaining your symptoms over and over and over again and being told either nothing, it's in your head, or ignore it, it'll go away, or here, take a pill. I mean, that's basically what you're left with.
Yeah. So one thing we didn't talk about, but we can mention it now, is the role of long COVID.
Oh, yes. Long haul COVID symptoms. There's that I can talk about from a personal point of view, because our daughter got COVID and she started to exhibit really strange symptoms about 90 days after she got COVID. And they don't talk about any of it. Some of it is hair falling out. Some of it is a little bit of increased anxiety. Things that are a little unusual. And from my point of view, I start to question. So I've insisted on her going to the doctor to have these checked out. But there are other really weird long-haul symptoms of COVID. I mean, you introduced me to COVID toes.
Thanks to my hairdresser.
Yeah.
And then so also really important is that doctors are getting used to hearing that variety of symptoms. And I hope they are getting used to feeling more comfortable with not knowing exactly what's going on and not knowing how to treat it. And I hope that they find some curiosity in themselves to figure it all out. But the silver lining of all of this, I think, is for these other autoimmune disorders that are difficult to diagnose, that doctors will be more accepting that this is real.
Yeah.
And it can be cured or at least treated.
Yes. I mean, better than ignore it. It'll go away. It's all in your head. This was a really, really interesting conversation that we had the opportunity to have. I hope we get to have more of them. Thank you guys all for listening. I know that this is a little different format than what we normally do, but we thought it would be really important and as a topic that isn't talked about enough. And since I had access, I wanted to provide that to you. So thank you all for being here, and we'll see you again next time. This is just the beginning. That's our show. I am so grateful for each and every one of you and your unwavering support and your continued belief in this movement that has become much bigger than me, much bigger than just a podcast. It has become this forward momentum that we are all doing together. If you are ready, or you know somebody that is ready to tell your story and share your value with the world, please connect with me. You can reach me at audra@womeninthearena.net. I am so honored and thankful that you will share your story with me, and I'll make sure that it is well taken care of. I will never stop thanking each and every one of you, and I cannot wait to talk to you again next week as we share another woman's story and we celebrate her doing extraordinary things in plain sight. We'll see you next time.